Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 16. You don't learn to walk by following rules. You learn by doing and falling over. Richard Branson.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Black Box. Now, guys, as filmtrepreneurs, we're always looking for a little bit of side cash, a little bit of extra revenue streams, and Black Box does that in spades. What they do is allows you to sell your stock footage, you know, footage that's sitting around in your hard drive from old shoots or stuff that you're actually creating for the stock footage market, but it allows you to submit to all the stock footage platforms at once. It handles all the technical submitting and also payments, so you can get all your payments out of one platform as opposed to going to all these other places and signing up everywhere. It does it all for you. I've created a really, really nice revenue stream from Black Box, and it is a passive revenue stream, which is amazing. So if you want to check it out, head over to blackbox.global to find out more. Today's show is also sponsored by the Make Your Movie Bootcamp. You want to make a feature film, but you have no idea where to get started. I feel you because that's exactly where I was years ago when I first got started. But I finally decided to stop talking about making a movie and go out and just do it. I want to help filmmakers break through their own fears and show them the secret sauce on how to make a profitable feature film. So I decided to put together the Make Your Movie Bootcamp and condense all 25 years of my experience into a two-day intensive. And in the camp, I cover how to flesh out your idea, the screenwriting process, finding money, crowdfunding, directing your film, post-production workflows, marketing, submitting to film festivals, film deliverables, self-distribution secrets, and how not to get ripped off by predatory film distributors. And I'll also have two special guests from the film industry talking about how to find money and distribution. This bootcamp will be held in Burbank, California on October 26th and 27th at the Hilton Garden Inn in downtown Burbank. If you want to get 20% off the bootcamp, just head over to mymbootcamp.com. That's Make Your Movie or mymbootcamp.com. So guys, today on the show, we've got Mark Stornoff. I always say his last name horribly. Mark, please forgive me. But Mark, I've been trying to get Mark on the show for a while now. We've walked in a lot of the same circles here in LA, but we've never actually met. And I've been wanting to get him on the show for a long time. He runs a school called the No Budget Film School. And he is a very accomplished producer. And he's produced many award-winning films, many in Sundance, at South By. And he's just a wealth of information. And this is why I wanted to have him on the show, to share with the Filmtrepreneur tribe all of his tips and tricks. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Mark Stornoff. I'd like to welcome to the show Mark Stornoff. Did I mess up? I was close? Stornoff? Sorry.
Stornoff.
I apologize, man. Thanks for being on the show, man. I appreciate it.
Hey, it was my pleasure. I'm excited to be on.
We know a lot of the same people. I think walked a lot of the same dirt paths here in LA. it's just funny that we've actually never met other than this time right now.
Very odd.
It is a small town, isn't it?
It is, you know, and this community is small. Certainly indie film community. I mean, relatively small compared to the whole town.
Right, exactly. But so let's get into it. So how did you get into this crazy business that we find ourselves in today?
Well, you know, I think I'm significantly older than you, and I started out, you know, as a kid with an 8mm camera kind of, you know, thing, which was probably my initial kind of foray. You know, I was one of those kids in school that now all kids are like this. I think everybody's kids that I know are doing this, are making films and cutting on it. Like back in the 70s and early 80s, you know, in high school, you know, no one was making films in school, you know, shoot things instead of doing book reports and that kind of stuff. So I made these little films in high school and then went to University of Texas. I wanted to do film. I mean, I thought that's what I wanted to do, but I was too scared. And it wasn't really a career that people did, although the University of Texas had a really great undergraduate film program. And I majored in business, which was something that, you know, you kind of majored in. And then I snuck over and did film classes and made some films in college. on 16mm, and really loved that and thought I was pretty good at it, although not, I just didn't have the confidence to really just say, oh, this is what I want to do. So I left and did 2 years of investment banking, which was something that, you know, I was kind of, I was in an honors business program at Texas, and it was kind of an easy gig for me to get. I worked in New York. And then when that 2 year analyst program was up, I kind of thought I'd earned some credit with my family and a friend of mine that I grew up with that we used to do skits together and stuff like that. He had started this theater in Fort Worth, and he was talking about coming to Houston, and I had moved to Houston from New York, and we were talking about starting a live theater. I thought, that sounds like an awesome idea.
So we built. There's a lot of money there. There's a lot of money there.
No, it's nothing about money. I tell you, that's the thing. That's my whole career. So we started this live theater, which was a total blast. I mean, I was the managing director. He was the artistic director. We wrote a lot of our own shows. I mean, he was really the writer, but I got to co-write some stuff and act, which, you know, I'm not a very good actor, but I like doing it. And I would do like the sound design for the plays. And it was a very creative business position. And we did that for 4 or 5 years, or I did that with him for 4 or 5 years. We had, I think I produced like 40 plays. We did we had a show in the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which was, the only show from Texas in the whole Fringe Festival, which was fun. And then at some point I was like, you know, this wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to make films as a filmmaker. And I had been keeping up with these kind of no budget El Mariachi. And it was really probably Clerks. I went to see Clerks at the Houston Film Festival in early 94. And I had decided right before that I was going to leave the theater and stay in Houston and try to make films. And I mean, I was kind of helping with the theater, but I had left. Saw Clerks and met Kevin Smith at the festival before, before he was anybody knew who he was. And I thought, man, this is the kind of movie I want to make. I can make this. I have $30,000 saved up. I can
right,
make this.
Right.
And so I had worked on a couple of local things and then just realized I couldn't stay in LA. And I moved, couldn't stay in Houston to do that. And I moved to LA at the end of 94 to pursue, my dream as being a no budget film director. Those kind of movies appealed to me as a filmmaker, and I thought they were doable, and I kind of, felt like I could do it. And it was very similar to the kind of theater we were doing, which was very DIY. And so, you get into town, you got to get work. I started working at Corman. One thing leads to another, and, you start going down this path. And my path has been, kind of a little nutty the whole way around. But I ended up meeting Peter Broderick in 97 at South by Southwest. I was going every year to South by Southwest from the very, first year in 94. I would go back to, to Texas and go to that festival, which was so much fun. And he had just announced this company called Next Wave Films that IFC was financing. And it was basically a company that was going to give finishing funds to these same kinds of movies that I wanted to make. And in fact, Robert Rodriguez and Kevin Smith and all of these filmmakers that I was like, wanting to be like, were on the board of advisors.
Nice.
Steven Soderbergh and all this. And I was like, oh my God, I've got to work for this guy. I don't know who this guy is. He was at the festival. I went up to him after a panel and said, hey, I think I want to work for you. I gave him a resume. We ended up, meeting when I got back to LA. And I think I kind of overwhelmed him. I had so much material and so much things I had been thinking about and working on that, I think he had to hire me. I was like the perfect choice. And,
right.
So I was like the first person he hired full time, and I worked for pretty cheap. So it was an easy decision. And so I worked with him for 6 years at Next Wave Films, which was just like kind of the perfect job for me because, I'm probably more of a producer from taking like a business background or whatever, mm-hmm. but I'm like to be hands-on. And when you're making these kinds of films, you can be very hands-on without being the director. And still be very creative if, depending on who your partner is. And, it was like this kind of dream job where I was actually getting a paycheck to work in this part of the film business that no one gets paid in. I mean, I know because I've been in it for so long, you just can't get paid doing it. You have to succeed and then move out of it, And I never really wanted to move out of it. I really like this kind of filmmaking. I love these kind of movies. I have no dream or aspiration to make Doctor Strange or whatever, And so I've stayed in it, probably longer than I should have from a kind of career
practical
standpoint.
Right, practical standpoint.
Yeah. But anyway, so that's, when Next Wave was a great experience. We basically gave finishing funds to, our thing was we gave finishing funds to exceptional low budget films. And for 6 years, 3,000 or 4,000, you know, movies were submitted to us from all over the world by, you know, by filmmakers of all different, you know, kinds and, you know, levels of talent and that kind of thing. And some very talented people that we got involved with, like Chris Nolan and Joe Carnahan and Amir Barlev, and some very talented people that we didn't get involved in that, you know, I met through that job, like David Gordon Green and Craig Brewer and Mark Forster and, you know, any number of people that were making films at that time that submitted stuff to us.
Those are pretty big names.
Yeah, now they are. Yeah. It's fun, you know, meet these people at the beginnings of their career. And we were really in a great position, you know, in the indie film world. We had money to give, and that made us important, you know, to people.
Yeah,
and we got invited to places, and
right.
I was always on panels and stuff, as, you know, I was always representing the finance people. And then when Next Wave closed and I was no longer the guy with money, you know, it's like you get tossed out on the sidewalk a little bit. But
why did they close, by the way? Is there a specific reason?
You know, it's a, you know, Peter has a kind of big discussion, you know, he can kind of do a whole discussion on that. I mean, it really kind of had to do with just the changing, you know, when we started in 97, the independent film world was a certain way. And then by 2002, it evolved, and it had kind of the studios and, you know, kind of mini majors or whatever had taken over that space, and it just changed a lot. The distribution became harder, and it was a great business model, but it was a very difficult business model in terms of I think the original business model was, you know, we would give, let's say, $100,000 to a film, and then they would do all the work. You know, the filmmakers would just take our money and do all the work, and we would rep the film in a major film festival, and it would get picked up by a distributor, and we'd get an advance that would pay us back. And then we would kind of be able to move on to the next film. And it's like, it barely ever worked like that. I think the Joe Carnahan's film, Blood, Guts, Bullets, and Octane was probably the closest film that really worked like that, where, you know, I worked very closely with Joe and his team finishing the film. So it wasn't like we were just hairs and money. I mean, I had to oversee that, and I did a lot of work on that movie. You know, and then it went to Sundance and got picked up, and the advance was, you know, more than what we had spent. And we kind of didn't have to do a ton of work after that, but every other film was a ton of work. I mean, Following was, which was a very much a success financially for us, was 4 years of very hard work, you know?
Wow.
Fun work, you know, it was great working with Chris, and we worked very closely together. Once we got involved, you know, but he went on and started doing Memento. We were still working on his film.
Right. He had already moved on.
Yeah, he got to move on. So I think it was just a more of a time commitment, and we weren't able to do as many films as we wanted to. And it was getting harder to kind of get advances that would pay back. You had to really work to get the money back. It was just, you know, number of factors probably.
Well, independent film in generally is not it's a very difficult business model. Yeah, unless you're smart.
You can come up with a lot of different business models, and all of them are difficult to make work. I mean, slate models, one of the first things I did after Next Wave was work with a gentleman that I met at Next Wave named Ron Judkins, who had made a film that we repped called The Highline that was at Sundance in 99. And he's probably better known as a production sound mixer. He does all of Spielberg's movies, and he's won 2 Academy Awards. He's been nominated 5 times, and really great guy and a talented filmmaker on his own right. I mean, in addition to, you know, being a smart film guy and a great sound mixer, we had started this company called Antic Pictures, which was going to be a slate. You know, we were going to do a slate of $200,000, you know, films. And I love that idea. And especially at that time, I think it probably could have worked, which was Henry Burial's second film. And Henry's my regular, you know, collaborator. I had met Henry at when I was at Next Wave. We did his first film, Somebody, which was a $3,000 shot on, you know, Canon XL1 movie with no crew, completely improvised. It was about 4 years before anybody had ever heard the word mumblecore.
Right.
It was exactly that. It was kind of proto mumblecore film, and it got into dramatic competition at Sundance. And, you know, I worked on that film in post, and you know, was friends with Henry, and then he approached me with this film True Love when Ron and I were trying to get Antic Pictures off the ground, and Ron and Henry and I decided, well, let's make this movie, you know, we'll make it for $50,000. Let's each put in kind of equal amount of money and make it. And we ended up making that movie, but we never ended up really doing Antic as a slate. Mm-hmm. We still kind of use the name, But he moved on and did his things, and I moved on and did my things. And basically my thing from that time on has been working with Henry as a filmmaker, although I have done other films without, you know, I'm finishing a film right now that Adam Ripp directed called Devil's Whisper. And I've done other movies as well. And then I also started, No Budget Film School around that time, 2005. So that's kind of been my thing since Next Wave closed.
Now with Henry specifically, I know you, when I was, I kind of discovered you when you guys started doing the whole crowdfunding for Driver X, which is Henry's latest movie. And I think in that, and if I do remember correctly, that amazing crowd, it was a really great crowdfunding video, by the way.
Thank you.
It was really cool. You were telling the story, or Henry was telling the story that, you know, he was between projects and he needed money. And he was, you know, and he went to start doing, Uber. I mean, I think it was Uber or Lyft at the time, which I found really, you know, refreshing to that someone like that has been at Sundance, has won a million of awards. And like, this is the reality of the film business. Like, yeah. Just because you're at Sundance or just because you're at these doesn't mean that you're just, you know, living up in the hills like Entourage. It doesn't work that way. You've got to keep hustling and keep working. And
it happens for some people, but it's
the lottery
most
ticket.
No.
Yeah, that's happened for some, and that's who everyone. That's what Hollywood shows you is that they always show. Like I always say, they always show you the lottery ticket winner. They never show you
100 million.
The 100 million people that paid and didn't get anything. So with Driver X, you raised some money through a crowdfunding campaign, and I know you've done multiple crowdfunding campaigns that have been very successful. Can you give us any tips on how to run a successful campaign?
Yeah, I mean, in a short amount of time, if I had to kind of boil it down, that's the tricky part. So I feel like, let me think about this. If I was going to boil it down, I think maybe the first thing that I would think about doing a crowdfunding campaign is, I think of crowdfunding not as raising money. I mean, it's a great way to raise money, and you don't have to give it back, which is nice. It's a gift to your investors, essentially. Mm-hmm. But it's a marketing thing. And I'm not a marketing person, and I've met people that are really good at internet marketing and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Better than I am. And I'm not, you know, I know enough to know how I don't, you know that much. Mm-hmm. But it's a great way to market your film because people pay you to market to them, which is kind of, you know, brilliant. If you think of crowdfunding as marketing, you know, and really everybody who's making an independent film, and really, I mean, almost every film period, I mean, studios don't have to do this with big, big movies, but certainly people at even kind of higher level indie films, like millions of dollar films, have to do this. But if you're making, you know, hundreds of thousand dollar films, you've got to be doing this, mm-hmm. Where you're looking at who's going to watch your movie, because no distributor is going to come along and pay you in advance and take your movie from you and you can walk away and they're going to do all this great work and get your movie out there. It so rarely happens. And if you've interviewed enough filmmakers, mm-hmm. who told you about, you know, yeah, they handed it over to a distributor who didn't give them an advance. They didn't do anything special. They did a day and date release and they never saw any money out of it and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, I don't want to get into all that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we can talk about distribution later, but you know, the smart filmmakers and the filmmakers that have these interesting stories. And I think of like Tom Putnam, who I've had in my class. He's a friend of mine who did this film Burn, this, documentary about Detroit firemen a few years ago, you know, kind of the classic, you know, there's a lot of these examples, but, you know, certainly that's one of my favorites of someone who, you know, really worked at finding their niche audience before the film was finished. And then when they didn't get that great deal at Tribeca, even though they won the audience award, and they said, well, why would we give our movie away to this distributor for $50,000 or whatever when we already know that there's an audience out there that we can reach ourselves. And they had been working on aggregating that audience. And so they built this whole self-distribution strategy around going to that audience, you know, directly. And, you know, and there were partners and people along the way. But so I feel like every filmmaker has to be doing this. I'm not the, you know, I was the first person to say this, has to be looking at who are those audiences that have to see your movie. You know, they're not art house audiences. It's not demographics. It's specific niche audiences that, you know, have to see it. I was at a panel the other day and they were talking about a Hula Hoop documentary and, you know, I don't need to see a Hula Hoop documentary.
But right. Maybe in the 50s?
Yeah. If you hula hoop competitively, and apparently there are a lot of people that do that, you have to see that movie. Does it matter how good it is? No, it doesn't matter at all.
Right.
It could be the worst hula hoop movie ever made. Mm-hmm. You have to see it. It's not discretionary, you know?
Or a wiener dog movie.
So if you own a wiener dog, you got to see that movie. So you know, each filmmaker, and it's harder for narrative films. There's no question about that. It's easier for a documentary about Detroit mm-hmm. firemen to go, oh, we're just going to hit up firemen. You know, they have to see this movie. Mm-hmm. So we've tried to do this with each film. I mean, we really tried with Pig, which was three films ago. It was more complicated, to do that with Pig, you know, for reasons I won't get into, just the subject matter and whatever. But with Driver X, which is about an Uber driver, it's like, okay, easy enough. Uber drivers, people who drive for, you know, who are ride sharers for Uber and Lyft might want to see this movie. It's about an Uber driver. It's written and directed by someone who actually drove for Uber for over a year. It's a very authentic, honest take on that experience. So it's not Will Ferrell's version of it, which I'm, you know, don't know what that will be like, but I'm sure it won't be mm-hmm. a depiction of it, unless Will Ferrell's been driving for a year and I don't know about that. But who else? You know, stay-at-home dads. Our lead character is a stay-at-home dad. Our lead actor is on Better Call Saul, and there's Better Call Saul fans. We have other actors on other TV shows. So you start to kind of think about, who are these audiences? My friends, my family members, the other people involved with the cast and crew's friends and family members. These are people that are going to want to see your film, you know? So I build all my crowdfunding campaigns from that. I say, who do I want to reach, and how can I reach them? And I'm going to reach them with this crowdfunding campaign, and they're going to give me money. And the reason crowdfunding campaign is such a great opportunity to reach them is that you want to build this audience up before you're ready to premiere your film. I mean, by the time you're ready to premiere your film, you know, for distribution, not at the first film festival, you want to already have that huge list of, you know, emails, addresses, and, you know, Facebook likes and Twitter followers and all that stuff, right? But it's hard to get people excited about your movie before it premieres, you know? I mean, you can show them clips maybe, or there are different things you can try to do. But there's really, I think there's like three or four times in a film's life that you can create energy around your film. Mm-hmm. One is when you start making it. You know, you tell all your friends, we're shooting tomorrow, we're shooting our movie, and everybody gets all excited, right? And then there's, we got into Sundance or South by Southwest. We're world premiering our film at a film festival. Mm-hmm. People get excited about that. And then we're premiering the film for distribution to the world.
Mm-hmm. Releasing it, right?
Releasing it to the world, you know, for commercial, you know, purposes. And kind of before you do that and before you do the festivals, it's nice to have, like, you know, people already knowing about your movie. So the crowdfunding is like a fourth opportunity to create energy around your film. And it's one of the best ones because it's very limited. It's 30 days. And everybody knows it's 30 days. You know, I only need you to get excited and post and do all these things for me for 30 days. And that's it. And then in that 30-day period, what do I want to do? I want to get some money. I want to collect some email addresses, which is, how many backers do you have? Because you're going to get an email address from every backer. I want to build up my social media. So I want to get followers and Instagram, you know, whatever, and Facebook likes. I want to do all those things during this 30-day period. Kickstarter is, I think, one of the best ways. It's one of to create energy around your film, to reach out to all those people, to have all these friends and people, you know, helping you reach those other people that you don't know. And we did, I think the, you know, we could have, I thought we could have done so much better on this campaign. There were whole avenues that we didn't really reach, but I thought we did. I was really excited about how well we did with people I did not know. Cause I didn't do very well with people I do know. In fact, because I have a huge mailing list. I have all my high school friends who all have money, and college friends who all have money. And I have like thousands of email addresses of people who know me. And you know, I wrote a blog article about this particular, I've written one about each one of my three campaigns, but I wrote one about this where I talk about, you know, how you can get email addresses, and which I gotten from this guy who calls himself the Kickstarter guy, Justin Giddings. And I talk all about that on my blog, but you know, you can get email addresses from your Facebook friends and LinkedIn and all this kind of stuff. And so I had this huge list, but I actually didn't, internet term? I didn't, when you, if you send out 10,000 emails and only three people respond, what's that? What's the
open rate?
The open rate, or the beyond the open rate, the click rate, or the
click through rate.
Or when you actually get them to do something rate, whatever that's called. There's a term for that.
Call to action.
Something like that. Anyway, so that was probably one of my biggest disappointments, was just I got, you know, there were so many people that I knew that I emailed personally that didn't give me money, that hadn't given me money before, and I kind of felt like they would, and, you know, whatever. But there were just so many strangers that, and people who gave a lot of money, like thousands of dollars, that I did not know.
How much did you raise on DriverX?
Raised $41,000 on Kickstarter, and then another 10 outside of Kickstarter that was donation, but it was not through the platform.
That's so nice.
$50,000. It's not, you know, it's not world breaking or anything like that. But I was, you know, considering how busy I was producing another movie at the time, and I was pretty busy, and I really wanted to have another month of prep. I think if I'd had that month of prep, I could have done way better. And then we didn't even pursue like press, which is a whole other thing that I've never done, that other people have done very successfully, where they go out and they reach out to, you know, get publicity. And there's companies that email you about that. Like, you can pay them $500 and they'll, you know, put out press releases. I've never done that. I don't know any specific companies that I've heard like really work. So I just was a little, you know, tentative to do that. But I mean, looking back, I probably would have done it. Cause I think it was a story that I think maybe would have gotten picked up, you know, the Uber thing, you know, and all that. So, but I was, again, very happy. And, so, you know, once you have these groups, these constituencies, I call them, that you want to reach out to, then you build everything around that. You build your video around your constituencies. And if you know, our video is very long. Mm-hmm. It's like 6 minutes long or whatever.
It was. You told us don't ever do one as long as this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but every moment in there has a purpose and has a reason, you know, and mm-hmm. every part of it is a call to some constituents, you know, see, whether it be a fan of, you know, Better Call Saul, or, you know, my high school friends, or, you know, when our lead actor talks about all the shows he's been on, it's partly for his fans, but also for my friends back home that'll think that's cool, you know, mm-hmm. that aren't in the film business or whatever. So,
right.
So people go, oh, I think it's too long. You should cut out that part. And I'm like, I can't cut that part out because I need that for that group. Mm-hmm. I can't cut out this part because I need it for this group that I'm trying to reach, you know? So
it worked.
Yeah. I mean, I think it worked. I mean, again, you know, it's always, things can always be shorter, but, you know, so, you know, your rewards should be built around your constituencies, your video, your text, you know, on the page. You know, the things that you're doing, how you're reaching them. And so all of that, you know, that's kind of my big thing. It's when you kind of follow that lead, I think it helps guide, you know, the way you create all your materials and the way you do everything. When people are like, I don't know what rewards to do. Well, there's standard rewards, but then you need to be thinking about, you know, what are the Better Call Saul fans that I'm trying to reach? What do they want? You know, and I want to give them something at $15. I want to give them something at $80, and I want to give them something at $2,500, which is, you know, there was a super duper fan, you know, we had a script that was signed by all these like big time people, and, you know, whatever, we were giving away the whole, all bunch of stuff at $2,500 for mm-hmm. the kind of super duper Better Call Saul fan, you know. But if you were just, you know, someone who didn't have $2,500, but you wanted to get involved, we had something kind of nice at $15. It didn't cost us anything, you know, it was a digital reward. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Now, what was the biggest lesson you learned when shooting Driver X?
Oh, man. So I make this mistake every movie where I try to do too much.
Mm-hmm.
I wear too many hats. In fact, I do a presentation about the making of the film Pig, and I added up like 23 hats I wore. And some of those were like smaller hats, and some of them were like, they were big hats, you know. I was the only one doing that particular thing, you know. And so I always said I would never do that again. And then of course I did it again with most of Pig. We shot Pig, I mean, most of Driver X, we shot Driver X in several chunks, which we often do. This time we had to do it because our lead actor was going back to New Mexico to shoot, and we would shoot around, you know, his schedule. So the first chunk, which was 5 days of shooting, I did have help. I had a bunch of interns. I had a very small paid crew. I don't remember how many people we paid, but it was four or five people maybe or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of interns, people that were not young interns, like older people who were like from my no budget film school list who were helping out. And it was nice having that help. And then that was like all the stuff we shot at the house. Cause you know, he's married, he has two kids, the lead character, And so there's a lot of things that take place at his house with his wife and kids and stuff. And then we had all the driving stuff, which we shot a few months later, which is a very completely different type of shooting. And the crew was kind of different. And, you know, we're basically, we're not shooting with a process trailer, obviously.
That's for rich people.
Yeah, exactly. That's for the $200,000 movies.
Exactly. That's just crazy.
Budget movies. Yeah. So, but you know, we had a terrific DP, Daniel Lynn, who had done a couple shoots, with driving stuff that we got a chance to look at and saw how he did the rigging. And we basically kind of mirrored what he'd done on these short films that he'd done. So in that one, you know, I just was the entire production department. I was the first AD. I was the producer, the first AD, the second AD, the PA, the, you know, I was literally the only production person. I mean, I had a little bit of help in a couple of, you know, in some certain instances, but it was brutal. It was just brutal. I was sending out the press, the call sheet. We would shoot all night and I'd get home and I would be downloading the media because I was the media manager.
Of course.
And desperately trying to stay awake to send out the call sheet so that people knew who the hell, you know, who was coming and where they were going the next day. And I was falling asleep. And the only way I got through that, actually, I use this program called Lightspeed, which is kind of an online production management, mm-hmm. you know, cloud-based production management program that's kind of their sponsor for my class. And I really, you know, that program saved me. There's no way I would have been able to make the movie without Lightspeed, mm-hmm. Because it pre-populates the call sheet with your schedule. As long as your schedule is correct, it kind of pre-populates there's a little tweaking you do. And then you just tick off names that are already in your, you know, already in the computer that you're going to be sending it to. And it just makes it a lot easier. I would never have been able to kind of build a real call sheet, you know, on Excel or something, at 7 a.m. when I'd been up for, I don't know, 20 hours or whatever, and then was going to get 3 hours and then had to get back up and, you know, whatever. I mean, it was just brutal. I don't know. I can't do that anymore.
Let me ask you a question though, Mark. You've been doing this for a few years now, and you obviously love this crazy. I mean, because I've heard the word brutal at least 10 times in this interview. So with that said, either you're a masochist or you actually really love it in a weird way. And believe me, I feel you because I'm a filmmaker as well. And, you know, I have a wife who is not in the business and she's gotten used to the crazy. And the only reason she's gotten used to the crazy is because I've been able to actually build a business around my filmmaking hobby, which is post-production and now indie film hustle. But it's lunacy, and I know, but you must love it. And when do you ever ask yourself, why do I keep doing this?
No, I do love it. And I didn't want to do it that way. I wanted to hire a first AD, and I could not find anybody. When we had a very short time frame when mm-hmm. our actor said, oh, I'm here. I'm going to be back because it's all top secret on Better Call Saul. We never knew when his schedule was. And I had to kind of quickly pull together a crew. And again, it was a small crew. So, but I could not find a first AD. And I mean, I first did in the past and, you know, all that stuff. And I thought I could do it. And there was a point in the shoot where it was very, you know, once we're driving around and, you know, we're out in the car and we've got it all rigged up and the actors in the car and whatever, it was fun. And it was okay. It was just, you know, it was doing the craft service in the walkies. And
yeah, that was cool. That was cool like 10 years ago, maybe. I feel you. I feel you 100%. I completely agree with you. I'm like,
saving money, I'm I feel a little bit better about things. That's because that's just still the Jewish person in me or something. I don't know. The no budget film school guy in me. But it was, you know, it was brutal. But yes, I know I love it. But I'm kind of a control freak probably too. And then I told you before we started, you know, the official conversation, that I have a horrible memory. And I think it's like, I forget how horrible it is. And I go right back in it, you know?
Do you have any kids?
No.
Okay. So I'll give you,
I have five kids, the house.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, so I'll give you a perfect example of that with that whole memory thing. When you first have a child, it is the most brutal thing you can, like, the no sleep, the sleep deprivation, the beatings, they just rip you your life apart.
And the woman, I mean, this thing coming out of her body, you know.
I'm just talking about the baby. I haven't even talked about the wife. Yeah. I'm just talking about, so this whole process of 6 months, a year, no sleeping and the eating and the pooping and all, and it's brutal, absolutely brutal. Then passes like 3 years and then you completely forget. And my wife and I both talk to each other. We're like, you know, maybe we should have another kid. I'm like, yeah, it wasn't that bad, was it? But when you're in it, it is just you. I don't know what it is about when you love something, you forgive it in your memory. Do it again.
No, I've said this many times. It's like having a baby. You know, I've said this in my class. It's like having a baby, and it's awful and difficult, and then you forget, and then you know what it is. You get excited about the next project. I mean. It's what I find hard is to do a movie that I don't care about. I've done that a couple of times. It's really hard. Oh, I just can't muster the whatever to do it.
It's too tough.
I
mean, it's tough enough when you're doing it for something you love.
Yeah.
Let alone when you don't. Oh God, it's horrible.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about Driver X for me personally, I mean, I didn't write it. Henry wrote it, but I feel that story. I know that story. It's, I'm going through the same thing the character's going through. I mean, it's about a guy who drives for Uber. He's 50 years old, who has been kind of aged out, or technology has disrupted disrupted what he was doing. And now that business doesn't exist anymore. And he is 50 trying to get work. And in a world that is now run by the generation behind him, and with new technologies, has created new businesses that he doesn't understand. And, you know, that he was in the music business. He had a music record store for 25 years, you know, right, and that obviously went away. And now he goes, in the beginning of the movie, goes to interview at a kind of, you know, internet music company or whatever. And he has no idea what the hell, you know, I mean, they're never going to hire this guy. And so, you know, that being kind of thrown out, on the curb, so to speak, pun intended, I guess, nice. And having to then, you know, take up in this gig economy is something that, I mean, I can't even drive Uber because my car's too old, but it's like, I mean, I know what it's like. I mean, I'm in a part of the film business that has gone through the same, you know, the same issues. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, this, you know, making indie films at even much higher levels, there's no money in it. I mean, I hate to say that, especially to, you know, on a podcast and in public and stuff, but there's no money in it for anybody. I mean, for lawyers and a few people like that, I mean, you know, you pay your lawyer, they say, well, I got to make at least $5,000 or whatever on any movie or whatever. So there's certain people that make money, but, you know, not producers and directors. Not if you make $1 million film, your fee, $1 million is a ton of money for me. But your fee is like, what is it,
50,
for a producer?
Maybe
oh,
50
no.
grand?
Oh, God, no. Oh, God, no.
No?
No, 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 no. It would be like 20 or 15.
For the 20. Year? For like a year?
No, for the whole movie, which right. would be 3 years.
Right.
Amortize that over 3 years. It's right. not a good business, you know, to be in. It's now, if you're a director, obviously you do that because you hope that you're going to be successful and then you're going to get an agent and they're going to get you TV directing gigs and you're going to make another feature that's more money. If you're a producer doing hotels of that director, and I know a lot of producers whose directors have went on and become a big deal, but they're, you know, scrapping to try to, because they couldn't get pulled into the studio world with them, and now they're still scrapping trying to make it happen. It's just very difficult to make a living as a producer on indie films. I mean, the world changed for those movies, and there's just less money to make them, and everybody expects you to make them for less money, which I tell my class, look, you know, make it for as little money as possible. I'm going to teach you how to do that, but you now everybody's telling you to do that. I mean, I was at the Film Independent Filmmaker Forum, and there were these foreign salespeople who were like, if your budget's $1.5 million, you better cut it in half. You better make it that movie for $750,000. Well, I would absolutely tell you the same thing, or make it for less than that even.
God, if you make it a seven,
remind you that your budget, your fee as a producer is tied to that budget, and you're going to have to figure out a way to make a living you know, alongside that. And the sad thing for me, I think, or not sad, but the tough thing for me is that I've never wanted to make any other kind of movie. I love these kind of movies. I go to Sundance. I see as many next movies as I possibly can. I usually see just about all of them at Sundance, every year. And, I love these kind of movies. This is the kind of movie I like to see and the kind of movie I like to make. And I don't want to make a Marvel movie or something like that. So it just makes it hard because, it's a very difficult, you know, living. I mean, I found, you know, had to find other things to do to make a living, you know.
And no, it's, and I don't want the whole episode to turn into doom and gloom, but it's something that I've preached many times. It is a very, it's brutal business. It's very tough to be out there. It's tough to make a living to like make, I just saw a Brian De Palma, the Brian De Palma documentary. And he was saying, he's like, 97% of these kids in film school are not going to make a living.
Yeah.
Like, it's just not going to happen. It was brutal for my time. I can only imagine what it is now. But the thing is, if you're smart, there are ways of doing it. It's not that it's impossible. It's hard. And for those people who understand a lot of aspects of the business, not just the one, it can happen. But it is difficult without question. Look, and you got to love to do it.
The thing that I teach a class, and my class is not depressing. You know, my class is not designed to be depressing. It's designed to inspire you to go out and make a movie.
Sure.
Because everybody's taking my class wants to make a movie.
Sure.
So I start off the class with, you know, the reality. I mean, I do it in a, I think, a very funny way. Mm-hmm. I try to make it funny. I kind of pull the audience and I ask everybody, are they directors and what kind of movies they want to make and blah, blah, blah. And then I say, who's in this to make money? Who's doing this because they want to make money?
Right.
And then I say, oh, okay, that's great. You know, raise your hand. That's great. Well, there are actually better ways to make money than filmmaking. And I put this slide up and it's like, you know, investment banking is a better way. I mean, that's the most money I've ever made. And then I go down the list of funny things. And the last one is begging. Begging is a better way to make money than filmmaking. If you're doing this for the money, you're just going to be sad and unsuccessful, and what, you know, money cannot be the metric for your success. And then I ask everybody, okay, knowing, let's assume that I can predict the future with 100% accuracy, and I tell you that you're not going to be successful doing this. You know, who would still make their movie? And of course, everybody raises their hand, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody. And I'm like, I'm warning you. I'm 100% correct. You know, I do this with 100% confidence. You know, you will not be successful. Everybody raises their hand. I'm like, okay, so I've told you, you're not going to make any money. And you've told me that you want to make your movie no matter what. So great. I'm going to teach you how to make a movie for no money so that you don't have to worry about, you know, the fact that you're not going to get your money back. It's, you know, you're going to, whatever money you're going to put into this, it's money that you are happy to lose. Because you're not going to get it back, and I'm going to inspire you to go out and make that movie because you want to make it, and the reason that no budget filmmaking is so great is that if you love making movies, which is something that Henry and I really like to do, you get to do it. I mean, we sat around. The reason that Uber movie happened in the first place was because we sat around a year, 2014, trying to make a bigger budget horror film. That I really liked. You know, Henry wrote it. I thought it was a great script, and we wrote it several times over that year, and financing was just around the corner. It was just about to happen like twice. Mm-hmm. I mean, I couldn't take a trip because we were going to start shooting, and then the financing fell through like two times. And then, you know, we never got to make that movie. And it's like, wow, we just spent a year of our lives working pretty hard, with nothing to show for it, nothing, not even a movie. And we always had a movie to show for it, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. And so Henry had to start driving Uber because he needed the money. And then we realized there was a better movie in his experience driving Uber, but then we got to make that movie. And so with us, I mean, it's not like we're not as prolific as Joe Swanberg, but you know, we've managed to rack up with several films under our belt, and I love that process. I mean, I think probably the making, the shooting of it is probably the part I like the least. Mm-hmm. But after that, like post, and certainly once the movie's done, like getting it out in the world, that's just something that I really love. I mean, if mm-hmm. I like the movie, I think the reason I made movies when I was a little kid and why I, you know, kind of deep, deep passion for doing it is just that feeling. I don't know if it's an insecurity or where it comes from, where you just want to create something and show it to people and get them, and they get excited about what mm-hmm. you've created. That's what it is for me. And that's why like that Kickstarter campaign, I love that Kickstarter campaign. I love that every 30, it was, I didn't sleep, you know, for 30 days or whatever, yeah. But I really enjoyed it because first of all, I made that video and it's not the world's greatest video, but I was proud of it. And I love doing that. I don't get to make films anymore. I'm not a filmmaker. And I got to create materials and I got to be creative and throw that out into the world and see what stuck. And I love that, you know, process. And so I'm hopeful that Driver X will be a movie that people really love. And God, there's nothing better to me than to know I have something that people are going to love and give them a chance to show it to them. And I don't know where that comes from. I've never studied it, you know, but mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of other people have that same feeling that do this, you know, they just love to.
You're an artist. You're an artist in your own way, because that's what artists do. Artists love to create things and let other people see it. Whatever form that might be, as a producer, as a director, as a writer, that's an artist.
Yeah, well, that's fun, you know. And so, so the thing with Driver X, I mean, something that I, you know, do on every movie, we do test screenings all throughout the process as we're editing it to test, you know, different things that we're trying on the cut. And we've done several test screenings, and you know, these are usually like 10 to 20 people mm-hmm. tops, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they're often friends and whatever. But you know, we have them fill out, anonymous, you know, forms, and where we ask some questions and stuff. And the feedback has been, you know, pretty terrific. I mean, the kind of consensus is that this film is very topical, that it's really hitting the mark in terms of what's going on right now in the, you know, in this whole, you know, with the Bernie Sanders stuff and the middle, you know, the middle class and the gig economy and Uber and all this like stuff. And so, you know, people have said like, you got to get that movie out now, you know, yeah. Obviously, you know, we have to finish it, which we're almost done with the cut. And then we have to, you know, we're trying to get into a film festival. So we'll premiere in a film festival. So it's not, you know, we have to kind of wait for the film festival first to decide, mm-hmm. you know, when we're going to premiere. So, right.
So what's the distribution plan right now for Driver X?
So I think, look, you know, I always, you know, for all my films, I always have like plan A and plan B. And plan A is the, oh, we're going to get into Sundance or South by Southwest, and some distributor is going to come along, and they're going to love the movie, and they're going to pay us in advance, and they're going to release the movie. And that's, you know, you always hope for that. And I've been involved with films that have that happen, at Next Wave and such. But plan B is more likely. And plan B for me, is again, this idea of building up these audiences around the movie. I have some specific ideas that I've come up with that I, you know, I think in the new year I'm going to have some time to, you know, I'm going to kind of finish with this other movie, Devil's Whisper, that I was hired to produce. I will be able to focus on some of these ideas I have for building up our audience with like ride shares, especially. Mm-hmm. And in the, you know, let's say we, I don't know when we'll premiere, but you know, in the months before we premiere, I'll be working on these different creating materials that will attract people to our social media platforms, and also to, you know, get their email addresses, get them excited about the movie, build up our list. And then with the idea that maybe, you know, maybe there won't be a company that comes around who I'd want to hand over the movie to. And then what I would do is put together some type of an event theatrical. I would mm-hmm. window the film out. I wouldn't do day and date. I would put together a event theatrical myself.
Through Tug or something?
Through what?
Through Tug.
We'd rely less on like a Tug and more like, I just went to this, I mentioned I went to this distribution, this little seminar that they did down the street at the Cannon building down the street in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And these three filmmakers, who had small movies that, you know, didn't get big film festival premieres. They played film festivals and won awards and stuff, but not that they didn't get Sundance or something like that. And they were each doing kind of small event theatricals. And one of them was this film, Li Lu's the director. It's a romance, a road movie romance. And I'm going to forget the title. It's called There Is a New World Out There Somewhere, something like that. It's not quite, I may be off by a word. There's mm-hmm. a new world out there somewhere, I think is what it's titled. And she, I came across her because she's from Houston and I'm from Houston. And I had given to her Seed and Spark campaign. And so I'm on her mailing list, and I've been getting all her emails about this little theatrical that she put together, where she basically started with the Seed and Spark supporters she had, and where was the strength in terms of cities, where were her strengths? And you know, one of them was Houston, because that's obviously, had friends and family from Houston.
How did she find out that information?
Oh, you know where these people are coming from. Okay. You know, you'll get their, you know, you get their addresses. And I mean, for most of them, I mean, like with my campaign, everybody that I'm mailing something to, I'm going to get their address. I'm going to know where they're from. Mm-hmm. And I try to know who everybody is anyway. I thank everybody personally. And how did you hear about our movie, and try to, you know, understand where they're. And when I send my surveys out for Kickstarter, this is something I'm doing now, I asked them, you know, hey, do you want to help us out in some kind of a way, however that might be? And you kind of start to test the waters on their enthusiasm. Do they just want to help you by giving you some money, or are they really interested in like kind of going a little further? And most people, you know, I have 400 and something backers. So let's say that only 10% of them are really, really interested in doing something beyond just giving us money. That's 40 people, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. 40 people who could really like do some work for me, you know, and help mm-hmm. us out, and they'll enjoy it too, you know, for whatever reasons. And so,
for whatever reason,
I mean, yeah, because they like this material. They love the actor. I mean, there's so
process,
many people who
right.
gave money because they love, you know, Patrick Fabian, who's terrific. And
he's awesome.
Great, super
he really
great
is
guy.
Awesome.
The nicest, greatest guy I'll ever work with. So she found out, okay, I have a stronghold in New Orleans and Houston and, you know, these certain cities. And so she basically found, venues in each city, like to do one or two screenings. She brought some, you know, she went to all those screenings. She had Q&As. Maybe she had some actor with her. Maybe she had somebody else on the crew with her. She would work with organizations in those cities. Like let's say in Houston, she would work with the filmmaking organization Swamp, which I'm very familiar with. And they would help promote the film, and she would talk about how they made the film to, you know, to filmmakers who are members of Swamp and, you know, whatever. And so for me, I would build this event theatrical, similarly with, you know, figuring out where do I have strengths? What cities do I have strengths in? You know, Atlanta is a city I would pick because my sister lives there and I can stay there for free. And it's, and I know a lot of people in Atlanta, and I've played the film in the Atlanta film. I played films in Atlanta film festivals, you know, several times, and, you know, whatever. And hopefully I would have, you know, a supporter or two there, but I have friends there and I kind of know Atlanta, for instance, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, I would build it probably initially around Uber Lyft drivers. There's a lot of Facebook groups for almost every city has a Facebook group. We would create a screening that would have some utility if you drove. Mm-hmm. We would offer kind of incentives for people to come. We would have maybe a panel discussion with quote experts, you know, talk about, you know, the driving and, you know, the difficulties of it, some of the tricks of the trade. We would maybe have I would get some kind of a vendor to sponsor a tour in a sense, like mm-hmm. a dash cam manufacturer or insurance company or whoever, you know, there are several vendors that are in that world. Mm-hmm. You know, I would try to build it around that, and we would, you know, have networking and a party, you know, type of thing so that other drivers, I mean, I know these drivers cause I'm already a member of a lot of Facebook groups, and I'm, you know, I kind of see what they're doing. They have meetups and stuff. And cause when you're driving, other than maybe when you do the airport run and you're sitting at the airport talking to other drivers, you don't really get a chance to talk to these people to learn this stuff. So, you know, we would have this kind of celebration of being a writer and, you know, and a driver, sorry, at this screening and create an event around it, you know, and maybe my actor could be at all those screenings. I mean, he's certainly going to try because he really is so behind the movie and, you know, we would build it around other things too, again, around filmmaking, independent filmmaking, if I can talk about how we made the film and tricks we did and all that kind of stuff. So I would build this kind of theatrical. In the case of Lee Lu's film, she did so well with her few cities that she did what's the company? Jesus. The company that does they do distribution in kind of like museums and media centers. Emerging Pictures came along and took the film to like another 13 cities because they liked what she was doing. And then what she did is, so you do that little theatrical where you're building up, you know, you're getting reviews, you're building up your list. You're getting, you know, hopefully, you know, you never know how you're going to kind of reach people. I mean, do it the old fashioned way. I bring clipboards and I hand them out and I say, you know, sign up on my mailing list. I mean, I did that for Pig all over the world and I had, you know, hundreds of email addresses that way. So then you work either with a distributor, let's say with her, she's working with Gravitas, or mm-hmm. you work with an aggregator like Quiver or Distributor, and you put together your transactional VOD window. And you basically drive as many people as you can to that transactional window, like iTunes. And hopefully, if you've done it right, and I've never done this to the extent that I want to do it this time around. You know, you've built up a big enough list to where when you do premiere the film on iTunes, you first have a list where you can get the pre-sale number up so that you're you know, whatever that magic number is. I've heard it's 63.
63 people?
63 pre-sales on iTunes will get you on, you know, in the top 10, you know, when the film comes out. I mean, I've heard these different, you know, these different numbers about, you know, trying to get, you know, pre-sales. There's a film called Slash that I also gave to, I've given to probably 120 campaigns. They were working very hard. They did a really great Kickstarter campaign and also very, very strong, kind of small self-theatrical and then driving people to a transactional window, in this case, iTunes as well, and going out to their 500 backers and saying, you know, go to our page, go to our iTunes page and pre-buy the movie. And what they did, in fact, to go beyond that, which I'd never seen before, and I want to find out how well this worked, they actually gave people $10 gift cards to do that.
So yeah, I was thinking about that myself as you were saying. I'm like, what if we just gave them the money somehow? So yeah. It's just a way of marketing.
Yeah, you it's a marketing expense. So you give them 400, you know, maybe that costs you $400 or something. I mean, how much could it possibly cost? And they had a discounted price of $6.99 to pre-buy, and there was like a tiny window that you had to buy it at that price. And so I bought it. You know, I want to support the film. And if they reach that magic number, then they would be, you know, new and noteworthy or, you know, whatever the top 10 lists on iTunes. And then the rest of the world would find the film as well. Right. Assuming that they had a good piece of key art and a good trailer, because that's iTunes is all about
key art trailer. Right.
Key art trailer. So, so we would, you know, try something very similar to that. I know that because I've seen, in the last couple of months, I've seen the guy from Adam from Distributor and this guy from Quiver give presentations, and they give examples of films that you've never heard of. You know, maybe you've heard of it, you know, most people have never heard of that. You know, that have a topic like, I think one of them was about UFC wrestling or something, where they were able to aggregate an audience relatively easy around that subject matter and got all those people super excited about the film before they opened it, and then drove everybody to their iTunes and did mid to high six figures on iTunes alone because of that. Now, I mean, I think that would be, I'm not saying I think I could do that for our movie, but if I don't need to do that because I didn't spend that kind of money to make the movie. So, so I think that would be my goal, would be to, you know, try to do that. I feel like I have a movie this time where I can do that. Pig was much harder to do that. We tried to do it a little bit, but it was just more difficult. You know, this one's, I think, a little bit easier. I mean, it'll be a ton of work and, you know, whatever. But that's the work I really kind of enjoy doing.
Can you tell me a little bit about No Budget Film School?
Yeah, so No Budget Film School, I started it 11 years ago, almost 12 years ago, which was really just my attempt to kind of, on one level, just monetize a certain information that I had that I wasn't making other money on. But really, you know, I had been doing panels and teaching classes at UCLA Extension and learning Annex when I was at Next Wave. We had done that. And I'd been doing presentations on digital filmmaking at Next Wave all over the world, actually. And, so I was very used to getting in front of people and kind of, you know, we always felt like we were telling people something that other people were giving them misinformation, like about digital filmmaking. Everybody was telling them, oh, you can't shoot on a VX1000 or whatever.
DVX
and we were like, you know, we put this, you know, presentation together that proved to you how, you know, absolutely you could, and, you know, with clips and whatever. And so, I did that for several years when I was at Next Wave. And so when I left, and I was, you know, had made True Love, I learned a lot of things on True Love that, you know, I'd never done before, that I was like, wow, I didn't know that could even work. And it worked. And I had this knowledge, plus the knowledge that I had from working at Next Wave, which I think informs most of the class, frankly, is the experience of looking at thousands of movies and, you know, knowing what to focus on. And people focus on the wrong things. You know, they think it's all about this when it's really about that, you know, and so kind of prioritizing, because you can't get everything right when you're making a no budget film. You really have to get the key things right. So what are those things, you know? So I kept hearing this misinformation about shooting on film or about, you know, just shooting with no money. And I was like, do people still don't understand this? You know, and I did a presentation for Filmmakers Alliance that was kind of the proto no budget film school. And, it, you know, people really liked that. And I thought, I'm going to teach a class. I'll teach a one day class that's everything I know about no budget filmmaking. I'll bring in a couple of guest speakers and I did that one class. It was really successful. I ended up turning it into a 2-day class, and you know, I do it. I've done it in different cities. But mainly I do it here in Los Angeles once or twice a year over at Raleigh Studios. It's a weekend. I've partnered with my old college roommate, Tom Provost, who's a terrific guy and a really smart filmmaker. And also, he's an editor and a screenwriter and a director. And he also, terrific instructor. He teaches graduate screenwriting at Pepperdine. And he does a second weekend called Cinema Language, which we kind of put together as kind of a 2-weekend, you know, immersion in no budget filmmaking. And, you know, I teach that class. And so, part of it is, I would say, kind of philosophical. Like, you have to understand the universe you're working in before you can begin to start making a film. So I try to teach them that. No budget filmmaking is different from studio filmmaking. The rules that, I cover these kind of 2 big philosophical ideas in the first part of the class. And then it becomes, you know, very nuts and boltsy, you know, go through, you know, how to deal with SAG on, you know, when you have no money. I mean, basically the second day is all about, you know, I'm assuming you have a little bit of money, but not the normal amount of money it takes to make a movie. So I'm going to go through all the different kind of categories, cast and crew and equipment and insurance and, you know, permits and locations and, you know, whatever. And we're going to talk about, you know, if you have no money, how do you kind of deal with all these different things? And it's, you know, it's based on my own experience. You know, if I make mistakes, I get to teach them, you know, which is good because otherwise they're just mistakes that you suffer from. And also, you know, I bring in great guest speakers who are also, you know, who have done this and done it successfully and who can kind of corroborate what I'm saying. And, I've had everybody from, oh my God, I've had Joe Carnahan, David Gordon Green and Ty West and Dustin Creighton
Oh, you had Joshua too, Joshua Caldwell.
Josh Caldwell.
Yeah. Who's just on the show. He's great.
I mean, I've been doing it for so long. I can't, it's a long list. Jody Hill. Anyway, all kinds of people, Jay Duplass, you know, who've come in and really just, you know, it's a room. They're in a small, it's not a small room, but they're in a room and they speak the truth in that room. You know, I videotape them. And I remember when I did Jay Duplass, mm-hmm. he said something. I was kind of shocked that he was that honest about it. And he came up to me after. He's like, "You're not going to put that stuff out on the internet." I'm like, "No, don't worry." You know, I taped them, but I haven't actually, I've never, this is one of the things I, you know, want to do when I have the time is, you know, start to get this stuff out. I've got all my guest speakers, you know, Chris Nolan, all these people on tape. And I want to start kind of getting some of that stuff out, you know, kind of, you know, free content out there. It's just hours of footage of this stuff, but
Chris Nolan as well.
Well, I did a screening with Chris about 10 years ago. I had this thing called No Budget Film Club, which I'd love to kind of resurrect. I did mm-hmm. a couple of screenings of No Budget Film Club, which was essentially a screening of it was like a no budget. You know, we're going to screen a no budget film from a director who's gone on to become big, and we're going to you know have the director there, and he's going to tell all the dirty secrets. You know what. You know, what it took to kind of make that film and then, you know, how that film kind of launched his career or her career. And I did one with Chris. We screened Following at the Egyptian right before The Prestige was about to come out. And it was a great screening and a lot of fun and had Peter moderate the discussion, you know. And then I did one with David Gordon Green where right before I think Snow Angels. I'm not sure which film was about to come out. And then, you know, we screened George Washington and that was fun. We gave away props from the movie. We gave away a dinner for two with one of the actors from his movie, which was a dinner at McDonald's, you know, it's kind of no budget film school. Anyway, and I'm still very good friends with the girl that won that prize. She actually had a great time with the actor and stuff. But, so I, you know, I have that discussion on tape, talking about Following. And Following is a big part of my class. I worked on that film. I know a lot about how it was made and, mm-hmm. and it's a perfect case study for the first 2 big ideas that I teach in my class, in the first half of the first day. So, I kind of teach these ideas and I use Following to kind of, you know, show the real world, way to apply those 2 big ideas. So
now if you were going to give advice to a filmmaker just starting on the business, what would it be? Besides Runaway.
Yeah. No, I would never tell them.
No, I would never. I know me neither. I'm joking.
I mean, I think, I mean, obviously it's an, there's never been, you can say this every minute and then the next minute you can say it again. There's never been a better time to make movies. I mean, really I used to say that. We said that back in 2000, we used to say that because the PD-150 had come out.
You know, or the DVX-100A came out. Yeah, exactly.
The PAL PD-150 had come out and we were like, there's never been a better time.
Let's go, just like, go. Oh. Yeah, you right. Know, and,
you know, I mean, my God, now obviously 1,000 times better than that. But there's never been a better time. Tomorrow there will again be a never better time to make something. It's so easy to make something. I mean, I think you have to create restrictions and limitations because it's otherwise you don't know where to start. In my class, I talk a lot about limitations and how good they are and where to create your limit, you know, where to find your limitations, create rules around your limitations. And then those are rules that you live by. So never been a better time. It's easy to get your film out into the world. I mean, to get it on a platform is nothing. To get anybody to see it is much more difficult.
That's where the rub is. Yeah.
For if you're successful, if you weren't successful 15 years ago, then yeah, no one was going to see your film. But when you were successful 15 years ago, people saw it. It got into Sundance and it got, you know, there were only, you know, they got out, it got out there, you know, but now there's a million things out there. There's every film that ever was made is out there.
So you're right.
Your film is competing with, you know, Citizen Kane. Cause I can just as easily go watch Citizen Kane online. Plus, you know, every video that people post on YouTube or whatever, I mean, there's just so much shit out there that is competing for your time. And so, you know, my advice would be, you know, if you want to be a filmmaker and you want to make something, do it. Don't wait around. I mean, you know, Mark Duplass has said this and gets a lot of press for it. You know, don't wait for the cavalry.
Yeah. Cavalry's not coming.
They're not coming. I said it in a different way before he did, when I created my postcard for No Budget Film School in 2005, it was like I had this picture on my website that says Holly Won't instead of Hollywood. You know, it's a Hollywood sign, but it's Holly Won't. Mm. And it's like, look, they're not. Don't wait around the phone for these people to come and sweep you up and give you a career. It's not going to happen. You have to make it for yourself. And so, never been a better time to do that. Do it cost effectively. But what you have to do is it's like you've got to hit them where they're not, you know. The studios will create certain things. You've got to create something so different from what other people are doing. It has to be so bold. And bold can be defined in a lot of different ways. But if you're not creating something really unique that's just sticking out like a sore thumb, no one's going to notice. And there's a quote that I use in my class that one of my students who became one of my star students, I have a few of these star students who took my class and then went on to make a really successful film. This gentleman named Blake Robbins, sorry. Who was an actor, before he took my class, he took the class. He went on to write and direct and act and produce his own no budget film that got into Slam Dance and was in, competition at Slam Dance and then got distribution. And now he's just finished directing a $3 million film that he was hired to direct. I mean, he's now a real director, you know, from that experience. Mm-hmm. He came back and was a guest speaker in my class. So he kind of circle of life, you know, came back around and he'd written several articles about his experience making this film. And one of them, he quotes, in terms of making films, he quotes something that Quentin Tarantino said, which is, you know, independent films are like waves on a beach. They just keep rolling in. You know, if you want to get noticed, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, mm-hmm. You have to blow up the beach, blow up the fucking beach is what he said.
Nice. Make another wave,
blow it up. Don't even think about waves, bomb the beach, you know? And so I don't know if that means anything for people or not, but hopefully that it kind of connects, you know, and just how different, you know, you have to be. And look, I mean, I know from Driver X, I mean, we applied to Sundance. We're alumni. I was able to tell them ahead of time, hey, I mean, I'm sending you the movie, and they gave us an extension. They knew it was coming. Yeah. We didn't get into Sundance.
Right.
And the reason I don't really know why we didn't get into Sundance, but I have to think because I go every year. This will be my 22nd year, I think. This year coming up. I mean, I look at the films that got in and in the films that are conventional, which I would say ours is relatively conventional movie. It's not experimental. It's told in a conventional way. It's not idiosyncratic as well. It's not super arty film. If you're not making a kind of unconventional or super edgy or super arty film, you're not going to get into Sundance if you're a no budget film, if you're a low budget film. The films that are like that, that get into Sundance, are made at higher budget level. They're made perfectly. You know, they're made with $2 or $3 million with stars and, you know, by filmmakers that have, you know, they're not on their first film and, you know, they're in the premiere section and sometimes the competition section. The films that come, that get into Sundance, and there are still films that get into Sundance that are made on tiny budgets, but those are films that are really like doing something different. And I think of a film like The Fitz from last year, which was a terrific movie, not commercial at all. No one's going to really see it. I mean, it got on the cover of Filmmaker magazine, but it's, you know, it's a very arty film, but mm-hmm. very different. And that film got a lot of attention, even though it's not commercial and very few people will see it, because, you know, because it was so unique. And so well done. And so you have to do something like that, whatever that is. I mean, for you, the filmmaker, your uniqueness is different than someone else's uniqueness. I actually go into a lot of that in my class, but I feel like that's what you should be doing. I mean, look, if you want to, you know, make something for yourself and it's conventional and make it as a showcase, you know, for a bigger film that you want to do, that's fine. You won't get into Sundance or South by Southwest, but that's fine. You'll, there are still other film festivals you can play, you know, but don't expect that film to get out in a huge way. Or make you money, but you know, it might do what you need it to do. But if you really want to hit the bullseye, I think, try to do something really different. I mean, it needs to be something organic that you know, that comes from you.
Right.
It's not, you know, you're not like just trying to be different for different sake. You're coming up with something. I mean, maybe it's just telling a story, you know, maybe you come from a small town that is really different that we've never seen before. And there's a story that comes out of that place that no one's ever heard. And it could be a relatively conventionally told story, but it's just a story that we just never heard before. Sundance always has those films. Or it might be a film that's told backwards, like Memento, or, you know, is doing something really radical with the way it looks or something like that.
Or Pulp Fiction that changes structure or something like that. No, what is the – now, these are the last two questions, are the two questions I always ask all my guests. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
At some point, you do have to make money. I'm just now learning that. I'm like, wow. I should have started that process years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Can I still make money now? I don't know. I mean, I've never cared so much about making money. I mean, not that I have any problem with money. It's nice and, you know, but
it's not your main motivation.
Yeah, I've never looked around and said, "What's the where is the money going, and how can you make money?" And I'm going to get in that business and do that thing. And I mean, kind of starting doing that now a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, I think I'm going to get in the healthcare business because, you know, man, you pay doctors a lot of money. You know, whatever. But so I don't know. That's a bad one. I wouldn't say that one. The hardest lesson.
Not the hardest, the one that took you the longest to learn.
Just, I don't know. I mean, maybe that. Maybe it is that one. I don't know.
That's a good one. No, honestly, that is a good one.
I hate kind of just, you know, sitting on that money thing. I mean, you know, even though that is my thing with no budget film school, I guess. But
it's a good answer, purely because a lot of people don't realize that till it's too late, and they just like they go down this long path. And I always tell everybody, I'm like, the word is show business, and the word business has twice as many letters as the word show. And there's a reason for that. And that's, you have to understand both aspects of the art and the business. If you don't, you'll never make it.
Yeah.
You'll never make it. Now, what are your three favorite films of all time?
Oh, wow. Okay. Maybe that's a little easier, although just like without even thinking, I'm just going to say Chinatown, mm-hmm. Godfather. I'm again, not even thinking really about it. And Monty Python, the Holy Grail.
Nice. Great combination, by the way. That's a fun night.
Pretty close.
That's a fun night. If we sit there and watch all of them, that's a good night. Now, where can people find you online?
So, No Budget Film School is nobudgetfilmschool.com. And we didn't talk about it now, but I will say it. I built that website in 2005, and it is the same website it was. I mean, I've added content, but it looks like 1995. Yeah. So if you're interested in subscribing to my newsletter and, you know, getting, you know, knowing when the class is, go to that website. Don't be shocked. I know what good websites look like. I go to them all the time. I've been busy, producing movies the last several years, and I've And I'm going to have a new website. And when I do, it's going to have great content. I've already have all this pent up content, like not just the video content I mentioned, but a lot of stuff that I've written that I haven't even posted, like case studies of no budget films that I've been doing for the last 10 years that I've never posted. I have a lot of them on the website currently, old ones, but I don't post as much now because no one goes to my website because it's so old and so bad. I mean, I you know, if you're on my newsletter list, then you get stuff. I send you, you know, I send stuff that I write and whatever. But I don't post. It's kind of a dying on the vine website. But you know, but there is stuff on there. There's a lot of. I mean, I'm very proud of a lot of the things I've written. I've written about Kickstarter. I've written three articles I'm very proud of about Kickstarter. I've written about, you know, doing feedback screenings. That's an article that I'm. Wrote a few years ago that I don't even know if there's a better article out there about, because I've looked for it in the past. When I wrote it, I there was no article about how to do like feedback screens while you're editing your film. So there's good stuff on there. It's just older, evergreen kind of, you know, material. That's one place to find me. DriverXMovie.com is where you can sign up for the, there's not much on that website, but the Kickstarter video that you were so kind to say you liked is on there. Her page, but you know, that's easy to find, DriverX, on Kickstarter, but DriverXMovie.com, DriverXMovie is our Twitter handle and our Instagram, and Facebook, I think Facebook is DRVRX. I couldn't switch it to DriverX Movie. Anyway,
no worries.
I'd already come up with DRVRX, which I thought was cool, but not as good for branding. But you know, you can sign up on the DriverX website on our mailing list, and I'm going to start, you know, sending out. Haven't really done it yet because I'm very like secretive. Or I don't know if secretive is the right word. I don't like sending out like pieces of the movie, you know, when they're half baked, you know, but I kind of promised that I would send out some stuff. And I think there's a, you know, there's a couple of things that we've cut out of the movie that, you know, might, you know, I don't know. I always get a little weird about like sending out stuff like that, but I may send out a few clips and stuff, but there's definitely going to be, we're going to be creating a lot of content going forward. That I think will be, some of it will be geared toward, you know, driving for Uber, like tips and stuff for that. We're going to interview some Uber drivers who, you know, are successful and create these kind of tip videos. We'll also, you know, be interviewing our lead actor and some of the other actors in ourselves and talking about filmmaking stuff. And so, and using, having B-roll from, you know, behind the scenes footage and stuff like that. I've got a lot of that stuff. I just haven't really used it yet because we've been, you know, focused on the movie and I've been finishing this other movie. So that stuff will start coming out. And if you're on the mailing list, you'll get to see that stuff.
Perfect. Well, Mark, man, thank you so much for your time on being on the show. You dropped a lot of great knowledge bombs on the tribe, so I appreciate it.
Well, this was really my pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark, for coming on the show and dropping those knowledge bombs. I truly, truly appreciate it. If you want links to anything that we talked about in this episode, please head over to the show notes at filmtrepreneur.com/016. I wanted to give you a few updates. We do have a few seats left for the Make Your Movie Boot Camp. If you do want to check it out, there are a limited amount of spaces, so please head over. It's going to be a very intimate, elite boot camp for 2 days, really going to go deep into the filmmaking process and how to make money with your film. So again, just go to mymbootcamp.com and sign up. And then a lot of people have been asking me about the book, The Filmtrepreneur, Rise of the Filmtrepreneur book will be coming out November 7th. We are close to getting it finished. I already wrote it. Now we're in the middle of going through the editing process and getting everything ready. So we will have it out November 7th. And I want to thank everybody for all the support, for listening, for making this show jump to the new and noteworthy section of Apple Podcasts. I truly appreciate it. If you haven't already, please head over to Film Biz Podcast. That's filmbizpodcast.com. Subscribe and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Please share this information to as many friends as you can. At least 5 friends you should send this information to, send this episode to, send the link to the website to, and just share this as far and wide as we can get it, because I really want this to get out to as many filmmakers as humanly possible. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, the power is in your hands. Be a filmtrepreneur. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.